It is Tuesday, April 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Barack Obama says the failure to plan for the leadership of Libya following the ouster of Muammar Gaddafi was the worst mistake of his presidency. The Afghan Taliban announces its annual offensive. And we hear about the success of an all-women's band in Ivory Coast. It's all ahead. President Obama acknowledged during a broadcast interview Sunday that the biggest mistake of his nearly eight-year presidency was failing to adequately plan for what would come after Western-backed efforts that ousted longtime Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. In a recent interview published in The Atlantic, Mr. Obama said British Prime Minister David Cameron became distracted by a range of other things amidst the Libyan operation. The U.S. leader said he views Libya today as a mess. His spokesman, Josh Earnest, was asked Monday to clarify the president's thinking on Libya.
The unique confluence of events, the need for emergent action on the part of the international community, and governing structures that just didn't exist, led to a scenario where the right decision was made at the beginning to prevent significant loss of life, at least in that specific instance. But the rest of the international community did not have time and did not succeed in following through with a plan to compensate for the vacuum that was left behind. And I think in some ways you could say that the president has tried to apply this lesson in considering the use of military and other circumstances. That asking the question about what situation will prevail and what sort of commitments from the international community will be required after that military intervention has been ordered by the commander-in-chief. That, I think, looking back, at least in the words of the president, is something that he regrets that the United States and the rest of the members of our coalition didn't do as it pertains to Libya.
That's White House spokesman Josh Earnest. He said Mr. Obama has learned from the mistake in the use of military force in Libya and will meet next week with Gulf partners in Saudi Arabia to discuss Iraq and Syria, as well as ways to press the case against the Islamic State, which has a growing presence in Libya. Regional analyst Alam Payand of Ohio State University tells International Edition's Victor Beatty Libya was another example of a short-sighted Western foreign policy.
I think the intention of the British and French, they took the lead, as a matter of fact. And the United States was very busy in Iraq, in Afghanistan. And so the United States rightly tried to involve Europeans in most of these places where things are getting dangerous. So they did not do a good job. This is not the first time that the United States or the United Kingdom or the Western Alliance or NATO has abandoned a country in chaos. When we go a little bit backward in history, in 1979 to 1989, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and the United States was supporting the resistance forces in Afghanistan for 10 full years, from 1979 to 1989. When the Soviet Union left Afghanistan, and President Reagan was inviting all those resistance forces to White House, and finally the Americans abandoned Afghanistan too. So then Afghanistan descended into chaos. Then September the 11th again provided the opportunities that Americans will go back to Afghanistan. And Americans are still in Afghanistan.
Is there a lesson to be learned here?
Yes.
Is American foreign policy too short-sighted?
I think that's the lesson, that the intervention policies are made. The difficult part is that what will happen in the aftermath of removing a dictator from Iraq or from Libya? The war in Afghanistan is longer than the Civil War and the War of Independence of the United States in 1776. And this American war in Afghanistan is longer than World War I and World War II combined. Going to a country is easy. Removing a dictator is relatively easy. But bringing peace to a country, stability, and some sort of sustainable economy in that country is the most difficult thing. And no one has a recipe to fix that.
Well, you know, of course, the president will be going to Saudi Arabia next week to talk about, among other things, the Islamic State. He'll be speaking to leaders in the Gulf Arab region. What might his message be?
First, a it is the problem of the region. Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Kuwait, Bahrain, they have tons of money. And there is Egypt and Jordan and other countries. They can put the boots on the ground because it's their problem, their suffering. The Americans cannot go to the front line each time. So they have to muster and use their military muscle at the same time and also use the diplomacy or any other thing that they can do. And Americans and Europeans can play a role of advising them, training them, giving them weapon and intelligence and that sort of thing. I think it's first the problem of the Arabs themselves.
That's Alam Payand of Ohio State University. He also praised the U.S. decision not to remove Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in 1991 when it directed a coalition that included eight Arab nations to evict Iraq from Kuwait. But he said the U.S. decision to intervene in 2003 to remove Saddam Hussein achieved the opposite result of what was intended, namely making Iran a regional power with strong influence in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, we have a story out of Washington here that Senator Chuck Schumer from New York is proposing a plan to reward people for turning in terrorism or terrorist activity on social media. Now, we've talked on the show many times before about how ISIS or ISIL is using social media very effectively in their campaign of terror.
Yeah.
And this is part of actually this plan that Senator Schumer has. There's already a Department of State program where they give rewards if you hand in tips about terrorism. Well, this would expand it to the social media and give a minimum of $25,000 for tips that lead to credible arrests or detentions, things like that. So we'll see if this makes its way through the Congress, if this gets approved, but it's a sign of the shift in how these tactics are being used and how social media is being used, both sides, by the terrorists, but also by the people trying to counter them.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, and a story that you brought me this morning, which is, I love this story. Anytime these kind of things happen on social media where there's this outrage over something that seems so innocuous, it always turns out to be fun. So, case in point, Australia is changing its currency, and they released their new $5 bill, the design that they're going to implement starting in September. And needless to say, it did not go over well with the Australians or people around the world, really, on social media. The has these little yellow things, which apparently are parts of the Moses wattle tree. They're different wattle trees, I guess they're native to Australia, that they are putting on these currency. People are comparing it to kind of petri dish. It looks like germs. People saying it looks like vomit, toilet brushes, inspired by Monopoly money. So not a lot of positive reaction on social media. But the Australian government says the reason why they did this is for increased security reasons. And also they said that these trees, these little, you know, vomity looking things, are actually tactile elements. And they're going to help people who are visually impaired tell which currency notes are which. So it actually does have a purpose. So the design may not look so great, but it does have a functionality to it. So I don't think they're going to change it before September, but I'm sure there's going to be a lot of complaining between now and then.
Yeah.
And hopefully people get adjusted to it, but we'll see.
You'll have to keep us informed on this.
Yes, okay. For sure.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
If you're an expectant mom and you want your baby to grow into a physically active adult, a new study suggests that you'll need to exercise regularly and stay physically active throughout your pregnancy. Scientists at the Baylor College of Medicine in Texas picked a number of genetically identical female mice that enjoyed running. The mice were split into two groups. One group was allowed access to running wheels during their pregnancy, while the others were denied that privilege. The Baylor team found that mice born to mothers who exercised throughout their pregnancy wound up being 50% more physically active than those born to less active mothers. The researchers later found that the physically active youngsters continued to be energetic into adulthood. Several groups of experts already recommend that women who are pregnant without any complications get at least 30 minutes moderate exercise every day. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a women's band wins acclaim in Ivory Coast. In Afghanistan, the Taliban has announced the start of its annual warm weather fighting season. The country's former hardline Islamic rulers issued a statement Tuesday calling this year's campaign Operation Omari in honor of Mullah Muhammad Omar, whose death in 2013 the Taliban only revealed last year. The group vowed to carry out large-scale attacks against government strongholds through suicide bombings, as well as attacks on NATO troops still deployed in Afghanistan. Ben Barry is a retired British brigadier and the senior fellow for land warfare at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. He spoke with me about the Taliban's pronouncement.
It would be in accordance with their previous behavior, because winter is now turning into spring in Afghanistan. There was, certainly in the later part of last year, there was less of a reduction of Taliban activity than previously. You know, maybe they were seeking to press their advantage with the Afghan forces, and also that their new leader, Mullah Mansour, was seeking to establish his authority over the force.
Yeah, now this comes at just in recent days. Over last weekend, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was in Afghanistan, and the Taliban, you know, set off an attack, which it did not affect him, but they said that was in response to his visit.
Yes, well, they would do, wouldn't they? I mean, I don't think we should read anything special into that.
They made a point of, you know, naming this after the late Mullah Omar. Is there any special significance in that, or is this just to honor him?
Yeah, I think it's that. You know, there are plenty of examples of armed forces naming offensives after famous victories or famous leaders. I mean, it may also be an attempt by Mullah Mansour to reinforce his legitimacy, because you could argue his legitimacy was knocked when it was revealed last year that Mullah Omar had in fact been dead for 2 years.
As far as you know, I mean, as far as outsiders would know, has Mullah Mansour been able to consolidate his leadership of the Taliban?
Oh, I think there's little doubt that he has done. And indeed, you know, the temporary fall of Kunduz last fall, you know, would have been a great boost to his leadership.
That's Ben Barry, Senior Fellow for Land Warfare at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. As a third Asia Ministerial Conference on Tiger Conservation got underway this week in New Delhi, the Global Tiger Forum and the World Wildlife Fund announced the world's tiger population appears to have increased since 2010 to nearly 3,900 as of 2014, compared to as few as 3,200 6 years ago. It appears to be the first reversal of declining numbers since an estimated 100,000 tigers roamed habitats worldwide. Darren Grover, National Species Manager for the WWF in Australia, tells International Edition's Victor Beattie via Skype the increasing number of tigers known in the world is a result of a couple of developments.
It is a reflection of the comprehensive surveys that have taken place in a number of the tiger range states, particularly places like India, Nepal, Russia, Bhutan. So we're getting a really good understanding of exactly how many tigers are in those countries. But a lot more accurate, a lot more precise. It's also a reflection of some of the fantastic on-ground management work that's taking place. A great example of that is the work that's gone on in Nepal, which is into its third year now of zero poaching of tigers. So it really demonstrates the commitment of the Nepalese government and the Nepalese people to protect tigers.
So how serious is the poaching issue regarding tigers?
There's really three key issues as far as tiger conservation goes, and poaching is one of those issues. There are still problems with tigers being taken from the wild and their body parts ending up as part of traditional medicine in markets throughout parts of Asia. So it is still a problem, and it is still occurring. The other big issue is that habitat loss. We're seeing in places like Sumatra in Indonesia, large areas of tiger habitat being lost to things like palm oil plantations and logging for timber. But then when you have that situation where the habitat of tigers is lost or it's fragmented, it means more people are coming into contact with tigers more regularly. And that might be tigers entering villages and taking livestock. And for those villages, having your goat or your calf is a very important resource. When that happens, there's retaliation.
On the plus side, you have a country like Cambodia that would like to reintroduce tigers.
That's right, and that's great to see. Cambodia has lost its tigers now. They are functionally extinct in Cambodia, but the Cambodian government is very keen to reintroduce tigers, and that's a great step forward.
Well, this report comes out and coincides with the third Asia Ministerial on Tiger Conservation in India. What do you expect to accomplish there?
There's two things we're hoping to see. One is that those countries that have committed to take surveys and other actions on tiger conservation, you know, stick to their commitments and follow through on them. But really a doubling down on the commitments of all the tiger range states to do the things that are needed to ensure that, you know, tiger populations are safe and are growing, and we're moving towards that target of doubling tiger populations in the wild by 2022.
That's Darren Grover of the World Wildlife Fund in Australia. Hollywood actor Leonardo DiCaprio is part of the conservation effort. He issued a statement calling tigers some of the most vital and beloved animals on Earth. He said he's proud of the collective efforts to make progress toward increasing the tiger population, but acknowledged much work remains to be done. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Editions. For nine young female artists in Ivory Coast, breaking into the country's male-dominated music industry wasn't easy. But their group, Bellamondo, is now a household name in Abidjan and is booking shows abroad. Emily Iob has a story from the Ivorian capital.
The nine women of Bellamondo win over yet another audience at this bar in Abidjan. This was the first venue to book them years ago, and they still play here weekly. Bellamondo is one of the few all-female ensembles in Ivory Coast. It all started back in 2007 when a music producer came to then-music student Prisca Alou. She says the man told her he wanted to create an all-female band to fulfill a promise he made to his late mother. He says she kept telling him he should showcase women making music, not just men. So Alou spread the word she was looking for band members and placed ads in local papers. She says parents resisted the idea. They would say they didn't send their daughter to school to have her go play guitar on the street. Being a musician was frowned upon for girls. She says in Africa, a woman's place is often seen as being either in an office or at home. That was a stereotypical image. Most of the girls Alou managed to recruit weren't professional musicians. The group spent the next 4 years learning to play their instrument. Many gave up, but eight of them soldiered on with Alou, and the band was born. Soon they began performing together, playing covers and original songs. Their musical style is best described as variété. The band dabbles in funk, reggae, and pop music. Guitar player Clotilde Blais says many didn't believe the band would last. People will tell us that women can't make it work, that they can't get along together, she says. So we took that as a challenge. One they have met. In 2013, Bellamondo released their first album, and over the years they have performed at galas, official dinners, and on stages in Europe and West Africa. Nodding his head to the music during a live performance in Abidjan is music enthusiast Kader Nanema. He remembers the first time he saw them.
Ah ouais, j'étais surpris.
I was surprised at first, he says. A woman singing, you see that every day. But an entire band with just women playing all the instruments, that was extraordinary. I was dumbstruck, he says. The band is great and the girls are top-notch. Alou believes Bella Mondo inspired other women to push social barriers. Today, she says, when I go out, I'm proud to see young women carrying a guitar, a keyboard or a drum around. And I know that we have played a role in this. She says, we gave other women the desire to do this and it makes me very proud. The Bella Mondo are currently preparing their second album. Emily Yap for VOA News in Abidjan.
That is the music of Bella Mondo, and they have been performing in Abidjan, a city I visited about 20 years ago, and I enjoyed it there very much. Well, in China, an emotional advertisement about leftover women in the Asian country has gone viral, uncovering not only society's deep-rooted discrimination against single women, but also, analysts say, the Chinese government's failure to tackle gender inequity issues. The four-minute-long documentary-style video, part of Japanese cosmetic giant SK-II's global campaign to inspire women to change their destiny, has resonated with many unwed Chinese women over the age of 27, bringing out their fear of being stigmatized as shengnu, or leftover women. In China, women are conventionally viewed as having an incomplete life if they remain unwed and often are pressured to marrying in their 20s. Well, that's our show for today. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Terrorism is insidious. In many cases, covert operatives of extremist groups attempt to infiltrate societies they view as their enemies and exploit established networks and institutions, such as the global banking or communications systems, to plan and execute acts of terrorism in an effort to further their nefarious goals. If we are to be successful in fighting this scourge, these operatives must be exposed and locked out of the global financial and other systems. From time to time, the United States identifies individuals who are crucial to the operation or specific agenda of a terrorist organization. Most often, these are part of the leadership or they help finance terrorist organizations. In all cases, these are people who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. Occasionally, the designated individual is already in custody. That is the case with 26-year-old Salah Abdeslam, who was designated by the U.S. Department of State and named a specially designated global terrorist on April 5th, 2.5 weeks after his arrest in Brussels, Belgium. A Belgian-born French national, Abdeslam, an operative of ISIL, was deeply involved in last year's terrorist attack on Paris that killed 130 people and injured 350 others. Identified by witnesses as the driver of a car full of gunmen that went on to stage murderous attacks at a number of restaurants in Paris, Abdeslam admitted that he had later changed his mind about detonating a suicide bomb near the Stade de France sports stadium, where a soccer game was in progress. His DNA was found on a discarded suicide belt there, as well as in a Brussels apartment, where another suspected terrorist was killed in mid-March. Abdeslam is believed to be the only survivor from the terrorists who participated in the attack on Paris. A terrorism designation can expose and isolate organizations and individuals engaged in terrorism. As a result of this designation, all property subject to U.S. jurisdiction in which Abdeslam has any interest is blocked, and U.S. persons are prohibited from engaging in any transactions with Abdeslam. By naming Salah Abdeslam a specially designated global terrorist, The United States freezes any holdings or bank accounts he may have, effectively preventing his fellow conspirators from using such funds to support ISIL's deadly agenda.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.